failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. In just a moment, we'll hear from Will Harrell, the executive director of the Texas ACLU. We'll also hear from Dr. Gene Tinelli out of New York, and we'll try to squeeze in a couple of reports from the Drug Truth Network staff.
I'm Will Harrell. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Texas and also the chairperson of the board of directors of the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition. For the past 3 years, we have written report with an analysis of the data that the police departments have to report annually regarding the race of the people who were stopped and searched by the police during the previous year. That report, incidentally, is required by a state statute that the ACLU and the NAACP and LULAC pushed to passage in 2001. The Texas racial profiling statute is considered one of the most comprehensive in the nation. It prohibits racial profiling, requires training of all officers and police management, and it also requires local reporting of the data of every year regarding the race of the people who are stopped and searched by the police. That's a basic summary of the statute. Our third annual report regarding the 2005 data was released, I think, about last week, and what we have found is some, of course, as you would expect, some bad news, but we've also found some good news on it from a statewide perspective. The good news is that about half of the departments and the police departments in the state of Texas have shown a diminished disparity in stops and searches. By that I mean, whereas last year and the year before, there was significant disparities in when the police engage in searches of drivers, the disparities was much greater in the previous years, at least in half of the departments. That means that the statute is working. When the Texas legislature in 2001 passed the Texas racial profiling ban, none of us expected that overnight this would no longer be a problem. But we expected that this statute, particularly the data reporting requirement, would provide a tool for managers in the police departments to manage the problem of racial profiling. And in half the departments around the state, that has proven to be the case. Unfortunately, I cannot say so about the Houston Police Department or the departments in the Houston area. But another interesting finding that under this report is that not only is there disparities of race, but there are race-neutral disparities. By that I mean in some police departments, anybody is more likely to be searched than in other jurisdictions. And the worst offender in the country, in the state of Texas, is right there in the Houston area, Fort Bend County. African Americans are 18, let me just put it this way, on the statewide average is about almost less than 3% of drivers are subjected to a consent search when they're stopped by the police. But that number in Fort Bend County is, being the sheriff's department, 11% of Anglo drivers are searched by the police when they're stopped, 15% of Latinos, and 18% of African Americans. That's a huge concern of ours. Is why are these police engaged in such high levels of searching? You know, whether people agree or disagree about the fairness or the moral basis of searching African American drivers or Latino drivers at disparate rates, we should all feel that our law enforcement resources, which are limited, should be used efficiently. What we have found is that only in about 10 to 20% of the time an officer engages in a search that's not based on probable cause, they engage in what we call a consent search. Only in 10 to 20% of the cases do they actually find contraband. That means an 80 to 90% of police officers' time is wasted when engaging in these no cause searches. And just to be clear for your listeners, a consent search is a search when a police officer does not have a warrant, they don't have probable cause to believe that you're engaged in crime. Rather, they just ask you on the basis of some hunch that they can search your trunk. Most people consent. And the question is it truly consent? What we have found anecdotally, and we can't prove this with any sort of data, but just through the complaints that we hear around the state, is that officers regularly intimidate drivers into giving so-called consent. But it becomes a he said, she said situation when a crime goes to court. And the reality is, like I said earlier, 80 to 90% of the time there is no court determination of whether or not there was it was a reasonable search or not. 80 to 90% of the people who are subjected to these searches drive on, and there's no record of that. There's no accountability for that. So what our proposals, in addition to requiring a little bit more data collection and analysis, is that these consent searches either be reined in or completely banned. There are other jurisdictions around the country who have banned flat-out consent searches. I'm talking in this case about the Highway Patrol in California. As a matter of legislation, in Rhode Island, consent searches have been banned. They've been banned in New Jersey and Minnesota as well.
Well, Will, this is a symptom, in my opinion, of the greater mindset that says anything that they do, whether it violates the Constitution or not, as long as they're trying to stem the flow of drugs, is permitted morally. What's your thought on that?
Well, there's no question about that, and I think that there's even a more sinister factor afoot. And you know, there are some decent cops out there who don't want to engage in these fruitless searches. They'd rather be spending their time truly investigating real crime, not just casting a broad net and hassling innocent people. They don't want to do that, and so what we find is they're often obliged to do it by a supervisor. And this is particularly true in rural areas where a sheriff department is highly dependent upon asset forfeiture money. Say that they're going along and doing their quarterly budget analysis and find that they are, you know, they have budgeted for the year on the basis of projected asset forfeiture seizures or asset forfeitures, and that they're coming up short on a quarterly basis on their budget. They will literally tell officers to go out and search more people. They might know that you know, 1 in 10 or 2 in 10 of people who are searched are going to have contraband. They go ahead and do it anyway. So say you're four seizures behind, you might tell your officers to go do 20 or 40 searches, and you know, just to raise the probability of getting an asset forfeiture and getting that money into the police department. Police supervisors are willing to tell their line officers to interfere with the freedom of drivers for the sake of getting that drug money.
Well, Will, that concept, 10 to 20% of the searches are fruitful, says something else about our overall society, does it not? That drugs are prevalent, they're in use without any of the the traffic accidents or whatever that would otherwise bring attention from law enforcement. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that drugs are being used. And there's another question about the propriety of this as a policy. You know, think about it. If you're trying to get your drugs from point A to point B, and you know that a Latino driver is four times as likely as a white driver to be stopped and searched by the police, or an African-American driver is three times as likely to be stopped and searched by the police, you're going to give your drugs to the white driver, and they will most likely make it to that destination.
It brings to mind another situation, not unique to Texas, but I think certainly focus was brought to the situation in Tulia and the task forces and the propensity of law enforcement to test a lie, if you will. Your thoughts, sir? There's Hearn, there's Palestine, there's other cities where the Tulia somewhat solution did not come about.
Yeah, that's right. And as you know, ever since the Tulia scandal arose in the Texas Observer magazine, we've been working to confront the regional narcotics task forces that were responsible for what happened in Tulia and in Hearn and in 16 other states. You know, we have effectively addressed those particular task forces that engaged in the work, the dirty work in Tulia and the dirty work in Hearn through litigation, but we've also pushed policy reforms on a statewide basis at the legislature that have been actually effective. On one hand, because of what happened in Tulia, because of the demonstrable scandal that was involved there, we were able to pass a statute that says that you cannot convict a person on the uncorroborated word of a confidential informant. You still can on the uncorroborated word of a law enforcement officer, but the so-called snitch testimony alone will not stand. That you have to have more, and that's what happened in Hearn, Texas. I mean, all those people, 28 African Americans, were arrested and prosecuted only on the basis of the uncorroborated word of a confidential informant. Well, that just can't happen in Texas anymore, and there's no other statute like it in the country. But because of we've been able to demonstrate that these regional narcotics task forces were just chock full of scandal and just inherently prone to corruption and scandal, many have been eliminated. When we started this campaign in 2001, there were 46 regional narcotics task forces in the state. Today, there are less than 20, and we believe that after March, there will be none. I think that's a good sign. The Harris County Task Force is no longer, and in fact, that money, which comes from a federal source, the Byrne Grant Program, is now going into your drug courts, which we think is a positive development, and that has a lot to do with the soundness of the judgment of some people on the Harris County Commission.
Sometimes it's hard to ask these questions. I don't want to cast aspersions anywhere, but the policy of those commissioners here in Harris County, mm-hmm. and of the council to allow this to continue. I've brought it to their attention. I know you've done your part to do the same, and yet it still keeps rolling, keeps grinding up citizens' lives. Your thoughts are, how do we awaken those politicians to this need for change?
Well, I mean, I think that while some of us may come to this from a perspective of freedom or sensibility, others might come to it from a perspective of economic efficiency. And what we know and what has been an effective message with politicians from around the state is to be able to demonstrate that incarceration doesn't work, treatment does. And if you're going to spend money, you'll spend less on treatment and have a more effective outcome than you will on incarceration. Or when treatment isn't necessary, community-based programs are better off. To get to the point of legalization, we're far from that. It's hard enough to even talk with elected officials about sensible policies such as allowing doctors, when appropriate, to prescribe marijuana as medicine. It's hard to talk to elected officials about the propriety of making it legal and safe for addicts to get safe and clean syringes. I mean, these are, to people like you and I suspect most of your listeners, common sense, but it's heresy in some political circles, and we have a long way to go in Texas to turn that around, but I do believe it's happening. I mean, if you look at the history of legislative measures and how far they go, last session, a bill providing for syringe exchange made it to the Senate floor. I mean, that it hasn't become law, but it's never made it out of committee before. So that says a lot. And your Senator Lindsey was a hero in that battle. You know, the medical marijuana legislation has made it further in the last session than it has in previous sessions. So, you know, we have a long way to go, but I think minds are changing slowly, but people are awakening to the reality of how foolish some of these policies actually are and harmful.
Well, we've been speaking with Will Harrell, head of the Texas ACLU. Will, is there a website where folks might learn more about your work?
Absolutely. You should come check out our website at www.aclutx.org. And another real good website to check out that focuses strictly on drug policy is Solutions for Texas. And those are really good, informative websites to take a look at. And with regards to general criminal justice issues, take a look at the Texas Criminal Justice Coalition website.
All right. And in closing, I want to kind of talk to the listeners around North America. The reason I oftentimes bring people, experts from Texas, to the fore is, one, we've got a lot of problems here, and two is to... I guess recommend that they not try this in other states. You know, we serve as a bad example here of what not to do. Your closing thoughts, Will.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, and we could even zero in on Harris County alone. I mean, 50% of drug offenders are going to Texas prisons from that county alone. And there's a real moral and ethical problem within that district attorney's office, but the voters sit back and let it happen. I mean, if people need to not only vote for president of the United States when it comes up, but they need to look locally and vote their conscience and local elections. You know, we elect our DAs, we elect our judges, we elect these people who have a direct impact on our community's lives, and we need to take those seriously, too.
And now for another Black perspective on the drug war. In many ways, the war on drugs is just like the war on terror. Both are based entirely on lies. They cost taxpayers countless billions of dollars while yielding no positive results, and they needlessly kill thousands of our young Americans each year. And both create, sustain, and increase the problems they claim to be fighting against. Both the war on drugs and the war on terror demand that we sacrifice our liberties for the sake of our security. Both attack our privacy and seek to sell us safety through surveillance, spying, and secrecy. Both are open-ended, and our leaders promise us they will last for generations to come. Both are unquestionably, unashamedly racist in nature. Say terrorist, and most Americans instantly picture a brown person, except perhaps for a few hundred widows and orphans in Oklahoma City. Say drug dealer, and people think of a black person, even though blacks represent only 13% of all drug users. Look at the victims of these wars. The dead, the disabled, the disenfranchised, the destroyed lives, and again, you see that both are wars against the black, the brown, and the poor. And we say we are fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. In the war on terror, we mean Afghanistan and Iraq. But in the drug wars, the battlefields are our urban communities of color. So where, then, is over here? Rural white America? Makes sense when you consider that in 10 American states, marijuana is the largest cash crop, and America's second largest after corn. Maybe we should take a closer look at just who is making war on whom. With the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
My name is Gene Tinelli. I'm an addiction psychiatrist and a trauma psychiatrist. I'm at the Upstate Medical University of the State University of New York, the medical school in Syracuse, and I'm also the trauma psychiatrist at the Syracuse Veterans Administration Hospital.
Sir, I see some stories today in the New York Times indicating that perhaps one out of every three soldier, Marine or Army enlisted man, is coming back with some type of trauma,
mm-hmm.
post-traumatic stress disorders, etc.
Yeah, somewhere between about a 10 and a third, depending on how you look at who has diagnosed and who is being seen for mental health issues. But it's in the ballpark of somewhere between 10 and 33% from the looks of it.
Now, this follows on the heels of, you know, the Vietnam-era soldiers many with PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say the curtailment of funds for the VA hospitals, etc., by the Bush administration in this time when we have thousands of soldiers coming back.
Yes, that's been a travesty. I'm also a former commander in the United States Navy, so I'm a military-trained psychiatrist, and, yeah, I don't have a sense of humor about it.
Yes, sir, and your thoughts, sir, I mean, we have many of these people will seek relief through drugs.
Oh, yes.
And then they will wind up in trouble with the authorities.
What's needed is some good information and some help where they can get it so they can get hopefully fit for full duty as civilians again when they leave the military. The trauma disorder is very often when you experience something very strongly and you can't move or you choose not to move or you just have to witness something. Those sensations set into the body at that point in time, and you can carry them for 30 years. So it's actually a disorder of sensation. The memories are sensory memories. People always think it's something you think or an image. It first is the body. And people will often use psychoactive substances to ease off on a lot of the symptoms. The most common is alcohol. The high-dose positive effect of alcohol for a soldier usually is to blot out a flashback that's occurring. It'll be back, but it can go away for a while if you drink quickly enough. To sleep, and it's not a great drug for sleep long-term, but short-term, if you haven't slept in 2 or 3 or 4 days, you just want to fall asleep. You don't care how you're going to wake up. And also for physical pain, again, it's not the drug of choice for physical pain, but it will lower the pain. Lower dose, it will relieve anxiety, but the most common reason people use alcohol is that it's the best drug in the world to dissolve the feeling of being ashamed. And very often war carries a price of shame, either in the assumptions you went over to war with of what you should and shouldn't be doing to men, women, and children, and war is evil, and people have to pass through it. So alcohol is the drug of choice, particularly for the flashbacks, sleep, and shame part of it. The second drug of choice is marijuana, because marijuana also can relieve pain, but it also will lower anger and aggression. And a lot of soldiers use this. Though, interestingly, a drug that people are using, and the Marine Corps seems to have a fairly high use of this, is MDMA, ecstasy. And that's interesting because it allows closer contact with people interpersonally. So that's the patterns I tend to see. And usually trauma disorders and substance use disorders overlap a lot. There's a comorbidity is what we call it, and there's a lot of folks that have trauma disorders that have tried to medicate their body sensations by using substances. And, you know, kind of ironic, they come to see me, and my job is to convince them to use my psychoactive drugs and to use less of their psychoactive drugs. So it's drug use no matter how you look at it, but a lot of times I can do things with certain medications, particularly what's called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, to lower that arousal. Although, for shame, alcohol is still the best drug, and for anger, marijuana and opiates are excellent drugs, but unfortunately, they're not obviously medically prescribed, and we have better ways with less side effects using some of the medications I can use with soldiers and Marines coming back.
Dr. Tonelli, you did mention MDMA, ecstasy, mm-hmm. and there are those in the U.S. that are trying to allow for clinical studies.
Yeah, Charles Mitover down in South Carolina is doing it, and there were research studies in Honduras, but the phase 3 work, the Israelis are doing work with both MDMA and marijuana, both medical marijuana and also MDMA for trauma disorders.
And finding some positive results is
very much so. The organization that follows that and tries to fund some of it is MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And Rick Doblin is the one that leads on that. And, yeah, it'd be good. I wish I could use it in therapy, individual and couples therapy. I think it'd be excellent. But unfortunately, since 1985, our esteemed leaders have deemed it as a Schedule I drug. So we're kind of stuck.
Yes, sir. Now, is there a website where folks might learn more about your work?
My work? Well, I don't do much in the way of research, but because I'm very clinically oriented, the sites I use for getting information or the MAPS site. I think it's MAPS.org, I think it is. I use DRC.net and Drug Policy Foundation. Also, an organization called Reconsider.org, which has links to all over for drug library and so forth. And I like that site, and it's a local group that was actually founded in Syracuse that has national representation.
As a doctor, you mentioned you see people coming in using alcohol, mm-hmm. marijuana, ecstasy. Of those marijuana users, are there physical problems? Do you see reasons to support the government's contentions?
No, none, zero. I don't. You know, the biggest side effect of marijuana use is getting arrested, which, can, if you're thrown in jail, puts you at risk for having a felony, which will never leave you for the rest of your life, getting physically or sexually assaulted. Getting exposed to HIV and hepatitis C. I mean, it goes on and on. But, I mean, that's the effect of just getting arrested. As far as physical effects of marijuana, it's an administrative law judge, Francis Young, who a number of years ago in the late 80s, the DEA commissioned to review marijuana and take a look at the harms and so forth. And his conclusion was, it's the safest therapeutic substance known to humans.
Creeping like a communist, it's knocking at our doors, turning all our children into hooligans and whores, voraciously devouring the way things are today, savagely deflowering the good old USA. Yeah! Reefer madness, reefer madness.
The right message, but the wrong messenger. The Drug Czar's office unveiled new advertisements this week. These are directed at parents, urging them to be responsible and take an active role in their children's lives. The ads are really quite good. The messages are right on target and should be heeded. I'll say it again. The Drug Czar's new ads are on target and should be heeded. Parents should be responsible and concerned and should take an active role in their children's lives. The Drug Czar's office has been trying for years through its ad campaign to reach parents. So far, there's no evidence that any of their ads have had a positive effect. Parents surveyed say the ads work, that after viewing ONDCP's ads, they have been more likely to engage in positive parenting behaviors. But surveys of young people prove that parents tend to overrate their performance. That is, they don't actually engage in the behaviors they claim to at the rate they claim. Yet, at least parents understand that they should do better. Perhaps the problem is that the current administration has very little credibility on issues of personal responsibility. That's why it's important for reformers to join in encouraging and supporting parents and their children in living healthily. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Well, that's about it for today's program. I hope you enjoyed our reports, and I hope that you're enjoying the sound quality of our production a little bit more. We built this network using a $20 microphone and a boombox, and of late we've gotten some support from others and some equipment that I hope has made a huge difference in the sound quality. And as we close out, I'd like to once again remind you there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, in fact, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. We've been duped. Prohibido istac, Ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker, asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.